Okay, let's wait a minute. This time I have the right date. I very often have the wrong date in the first slide for some magic action. I have the right date. Okay, so I should start. Well, I owe a lot to Abner because many of the things he did, and particularly the way of his thinking, were very important for me. This was a, I show a few of the parallels and of the things I learned from you. I would like to mention that the first time we met was in 1976. That was in Erice, if you remember, in Sicily. There was a conference called Think Shops in Physics, organized by John Bell and by Bernard d'Espagnat. And we had just done our first neutron interferometry experiments. And I went there because it said Foundations of Quantum Mechanics, and I had no idea what expected me there. To be honest, I didn't understand anything. People were talking about locality, reality, detection loopholes and whatsoever. And at that time, I didn't know that I might be working one day in the field. It took another 10 years until I got into it, which is quite interesting, actually. But already at this meeting, there were, I think, Abner was here, then Mike was there, Alain was there, right, who else in the audience? You were there, Ed Fry was there. It was quite an interesting, it was a very unusual conference. 1976, Yeah, right. Yeah, this is quite interesting. I also remember another thing, that the camera of one of us was stolen when he was down in Trapani. And 2 days later, it appeared again with an apology that they said they didn't know that he was with the conference. Okay, so anyway, okay, there at this conference, and Mike already mentioned this very special feature of Abner, that he always wants to talk about experiments. He also wants a connection to reality. At this conference, the thing I talked about back then was what we call the 4-pi spinor rotation experiment, and that's the reason why I went to the conference. Is the simple fact, you all know this now, that when you rotate a spinor wave function by 2 pi, you get a minus sign. And the way we did it was an interference experiment. This is a neutron interferometer. Here are the people on the work. This was in the group of Helmut Rauch and with Bonse, German collaboration, Bauspies and Bonse. And so this is the way we do the experiment. And magnetic field over one arm of a neutron interferometer, and these are the interference fringes. At that conference, I learned from Mike and Abner that they had been thinking about the same kind of experiment, but with a neutron, with an electron interferometer. And as far as I know, this work of yours has never been published. I don't know of any paper where this is mentioned. Right. Well, it was done by us in Vienna and in Missouri at the same time. It was simultaneous. It was simultaneous in Vienna and in Missouri. And you never published your proposal because, okay, right. So this was the first parallel of our work. The second thing was actually already triggered by Abner. There was a very interesting idea in 1975 by Bialynicki, Birola, and Micielski, two Polish colleagues, who proposed a nonlinear variant of the Schrödinger equation. These terms are all standard Schrödinger equation. But they said, okay, well, maybe there is a term in addition to the Schrödinger equation, which is some function of the density. And the basic idea was to have, one might call it a self-potential. This is for individual particles, not for ensembles, like in the Bose-Einstein condensate, but for individual particles. Is to have something like a self-potential, which keeps the wave packet together, which keeps the wave packet from spreading. It's a very clever idea. And what was particularly clever in these papers, there were two papers by these two people, was that they found out that if you have a specific form of this function, which is where you have an energy term, clearly, because the Schrödinger equation is an energy equation, where the dependence is on the log of psi squared, then you have a beautiful feature, namely that non-interacting subsystems separate into separate equations. So it's actually a very reasonable concept. And we didn't know about this paper, but we learned very soon, because I was at that time already working with Cliff Schall. This is his picture from the Nobel homepage. Cliff Schall in the neutron diffraction laboratory at MIT, I worked together with Mike Hoan here and with Danny Greenberger and also with Herb Bernstein. What Abner had a very good idea. Using this neutron interferometer, he suggested that there must be a consequence of this nonlinear equation because of the fact that this additional term is effectively acts like a potential in the Schrödinger equation, and therefore we know that any potential in the Schrödinger equation changes the phase of the state, and therefore this term should also change the phase of the state depending now on the density. So if you have two states with different amplitude, then a new phase factor should arrive, which should be observable in neutron interferometry. That was the suggestion of Abner in 1979. And the experiment was actually done in Schall groups, Schall, Atwood, Arthur, and Horn in 1980. This is a neutron interferometer, which we had developed there earlier. You basically split with perfect crystal. You split an incoming beam into coherent beams. There's actually a bunch of beams there. And then the idea of Abner was simply to attenuate one of the beams, and attenuate either this one early, this one late, or vice versa, this one early, this one late. And then by switching between the two, you should switch between two phases. The experiment proved, gave a number, gave a limit on the Schrödinger on this nonlinear term. But as I said, Abner's idea also triggered us to try another experiment, and that is a collaboration with Roland Gehler and Tony Klein. Roland Gehler from Munich, Tony Klein from Melbourne, Australia, in 1981. And the question we asked ourselves, if you have a nonlinearity in the equation, the best way to test for it is to look for some transients if you introduce an as sharp discontinuity as possible. And what is the sharpest possible discontinuity? It's simply putting a straight edge into the beam and absorbing straight edge. There you get a step of the wave function. And as you know, this is the something like an expected interference pattern. And if there were such a nonlinear equation, you would expect actually a movement of this slope here towards the maxima by a little bit. So in the experiment, you precisely look for the distance of this famous quarter amplitude, the quarter intensity point, relative to the maxima, and that gives you a limit on this nonlinear term. The experiment, I show you the experimental picture here because it was extremely simple. The experiment basically was simple. It was not so easy to set up. You have neutrons coming from the high flux reactor in Grenoble with the wavelengths of 2 nanometers, 20 angstroms, which is very slow for neutrons, very cold. Usual neutrons out of the reactor have a wavelength which is a factor of 10 smaller than that, and as a velocity of 200 meters per second. Then we monochromize our neutrons by refraction at the prism. You see that the refraction here goes in the wrong way because the refractive index for neutrons is smaller than 1, actually. It's quite interesting, slightly smaller than 1. And then you have some entrance slit, which defines the beam, a straight edge after 5 meters. And back there, you collect the interference pattern. And here's the experimental results together with the prediction from linear theory. And by looking at the sensitivity of our experiment, what would we have been able to detect? We were able to put a limit on this nonlinearity of the order of 3 × 10⁻⁵ electron volts, which was about 2 orders of magnitude smaller than the other experiment, basically because the interaction time, flight time, is so much larger in that experiment. And the interesting point conceptually was that I told you before that this Bielinitsky-Birula idea was to have a term which keeps wave packets from spreading, which limits the spreading of wave packets. And this kind of limit says that electron wave packets have to spread to at least a size of 3 millimeters, which is a macroscopic size. So it doesn't keep wave packets from spreading to macroscopic things. But now we have experiments with larger distances and so on. But at that time it was the limit. So this kind of experiment basically killed the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, but it still was a nice experiment. As I said, it was triggered by Abner's paper. Actually, Abner must have been looking through the literature all the time to see what can be experimentally tested in a sense. This applies to the Bell's work and also this. This is a nice little side product I just want to mention. Back then, we also did a diffraction at an absorbing wire, and here you see a little peak in the middle, which is what's called Poisson's spot. You know, there's the famous story that Poisson didn't believe into the wave theory proposed by Fresnel at the Academy of Sciences in France, and Arago, who was there, went home and did the experiment because the prediction was this maximum in the center behind an absorbing object. In my eyes, the spot should be called Arago's spot, but never mind. He found it experimentally. So I just want to go through a few things which might be of interest because they might be conceptually interesting. Many of you know that we are one of the programs of our group is to ask experimentally whether we can go for how large objects we can verify quantum interference. That's an experiment we did a couple of years ago. Diffraction at a massive grating with spacings of the order of 100 nanometers of fullerenes, and here's the observed interference pattern, which I show you mainly for one reason, which is interesting. The solid line is calculation from a simple Fraunhofer wave model, just the very standard, like every optics textbook. And this looks as if, you know, the side peaks here are larger. So it looks as if the behavior of the fullerenes is better than what quantum mechanics wants you to do. Now, the explanation is a very interesting one. This is actually a signature of the Casimir force. The point is that when you are when your molecules fly through the gratings here, this is like a channel. And depending on where the molecule flies through, it is closer or further away from the walls of this grating. And therefore, it experiences a different Casimir force depending on where it goes through. And therefore, it experiences a different phase. Remember, phase, potential is phase. A different phase, which provides for a what crystallographers call a phase factor in the phenomenon. And a phase factor leads to higher side maximum and interference pattern. So I like to say that what we see here is a nice confirmation of what Feynman once said: yesterday's sensation is today's calibration and tomorrow's background. In our experiment, the Casimir force is a background. Just one conceptually interesting point. Back at that time, there were still theories around where people, like a kind of the Bowie-Bohm series variants, where people in the head thought of the wave as a spread out phenomenon, and the particle is the small localized thing. Now, here's just the other way around. In this kind of experiment, these are not the only experiments where you see this that way, but here it's nice, very clear. If you take your molecule here, the size of the molecule is of the order of one nanometer. If you calculate the Bowie wavelengths of our molecules, the Bowie wavelengths at the molecules are at the temperature of at the temperature of 900 Kelvin. I didn't mention that, so they're very hot. So the Bowie wavelengths at that temperature is 3 × 10⁻¹² meters, which is much smaller than the size of the thing. The wavelength is only about the width of this red line. It's furthermore, the coherence length, so the wave packet length, is only 2 to 5 the Bowie wavelength. So this is just the other way around. The Bowie wave is something localized inside at the center of mass, where you have no atoms at all, nothing, and the object is very big. This is just to underline that naive pictures are not appropriate to try to understand what's going on here. On this matter wave interference experiments, just one experiment which you might find interesting. These first experiments were done with diffraction gratings. We now have an interferometer that was developed essentially by Lucia Hackermüller, which consists of three gold gratings with 1 micrometer grating constant. And the way you see the interference pattern there is that you translate the third grating and you measure the total intensity behind the third grating, which follows a sinusoidal pattern. That's quite clear, very simple. An interesting question is study we did was to look at the decoherence in this kind of experiment, which you might call a transition to classical dynamics. So there are two main mechanisms of decoherence. One is scattering from scattering of individual molecules in the background gas. So we can vary the density of the background gas and which kind of background you have. And there the story is very simple. One scattering decoheres the whole interference pattern. More interesting is the decoherence by emission of photons. So the story is now to heat up these buckyballs such that they emit photons and see what happens. Now, the basic story, to cut it short, is that as soon as the photons emitted by the buckyball, it would allow you, at least in principle, to find out which of the paths the molecule took, then the interference pattern disappears. Now, here's the basic idea of the experiment again. Maybe I go slowly through it. We have our buckyball here, and it passes through a couple of strong laser beams, about 10 laser beams out of an argon iron laser of 25 watts power, so it's a lot. And what happens is that these molecules get heated up to temperatures of the order of 6,000 degrees Kelvin, 5,000, 6,000 degrees Kelvin. And there, a first interesting thing happens, namely that the molecules do not break apart. They do not break apart. The reason why they don't break apart is that it takes more time for them to break apart than to emit the radiation and cool down. It's quite funny. Okay, so the molecules emit radiation, and they enter the grating at some temperature, and they are still glowing. I will tell you about this temperature in a moment. And, you know, I apologize to have such a naive picture with a wave front. I know one should not draw wave fronts because they don't really exist. So a wave front develops, and then at some point, the molecule might emit a photon or more than one photon, and that localizes the molecule and the interference fringe disappears. Now, to show you some data, at a power of about 4 watts of the total laser, this can be translated into temperature in a second, you see a nice interference pattern, nice interference fringes. If you raise the power to about 6 watts, the fringes go down, and if we go further up, the fringes finally disappear. Because the hotter the molecule, there's a modified Stefan-Boltzmann law at work here, because the molecule emits photons, and the photons would allow you, at least in principle, to find out which path the molecule takes. Now, here's a picture which summarizes all the experiments. These are the people on the paper. The experiments was mainly done by Lucia Hackermüller, Björn Brezka, and Markus Arndt. Markus Arndt has now completely taken over all these experiments. He has this laboratory now for his own. And Klaus Hornberger did the theory of the decoherence as a function of temperature. What you see here is the interference visibility as a function of the temperature when the molecules enter the first grating. Molecules enter the first grating. The important point is, which I want you to take home, is that you see that at even at temperatures close to 3,000 Kelvin, 2,800 Kelvin, we still have some noticeable interference. So it is not necessary to cool down your systems to low temperatures to see interferences. Now, as I said, these experiments are now done by Markus Arndt, and he's working hard to see interferences of larger objects. There's one result from these experiments which you might find interesting, and that is we used these fullerenes at temperatures up to 3,000 Kelvin. Now, if you apply basic scaling considerations, like the modified Stefan-Boltzmann law to allow for temperature changes, and some assumptions about how the emission of photons scales with the size of the molecule, we are really sure that in such an experiment we will have no decoherence for the masses of small viruses at room temperature. So we are not talking about cooling down. Masses of the order of 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 atomic mass unit. And I personally believe once one goes there, one can go much further. And just to stick my neck out, I personally believe that there is no limit. I personally believe that in the end of all these experiments trying to demonstrate quantum mechanics or to test quantum mechanics, we will find that quantum mechanics is universally valid. It might even be possible to see interference of living objects someday. If you want to know, I can tell you in the discussion how I would do it. Okay? Now, to go back to a conceptual point, which I want to mention. A conceptual point is the following. What you see here is a picture. I took it from the internet, from the homepage of a company which sells scanning tunneling microscopes. And this is a picture of fullerenes sitting on some surfaces. These are the individual buckyball molecules. Just to compare it now with the previous experiment, what you saw previously, here, you see that this is the scale. The diameter is 1 nanometer. In the previous experiment, the fullerenes are delocalized on the scale of 1 micrometer, which is 100 times larger. So in the early in the other experiments, these fullerenes are delocalized on the scale which is much larger than this picture here. In that experiment, they are localized. So the reason I show this is because it tells you that Bohr was right. There is no border between quantum and classical. There is no mass from which objects start to be quantum or start to be classical. It's simply your choice as the experimentalist which experiment you do, whether a given object behaves classically when you look at it with a microscope, or whether it behaves quantum mechanically when you do an experiment such that no information whatsoever is contained anywhere in the universe of which path the particle took. Now, I want to, I want to mention a few experiments which I hope Abner might find conceptually interesting. this is an experiment we did recently. Walter and Resch are the experimentalists. Czaslaw Bruckner is a theorist on the experiment. It's a very simple experiment. We look at a state which can be written like that. It's an entangled state of three photons. Entangled state of three photons. And the point is that you have an entanglement in such a way that either photon one is horizontally polarized, then then the other two photons, photon two and three, are in a phi minus entangled state, in a phi minus entangled state, which is, you know, plus plus minus plus plus minus minus minus, or horizontal horizontal minus vertical vertical. Or the first photon is vertically polarized, then the other two photons are in a psi plus entangled state, which is horizontal vertical plus vertical horizontal. Now, the point we want to the whole machinery applies as well to this kind of situation as it does to a simple two particle correlation. You now can actually, this is a GHC state. If you write it in another basis, it's simply RRR plus LLL, where these are right-handed and left-handed circular polarization. Now, the interesting point here is that now you can introduce elements of reality, but elements of, as you know, in any of these two particle or three particle correlations, you have elements of reality, saying that based on one observation here, you can predict with certainty the property of another system over there. But now this is a funny element of reality. I know it's nothing new, but it may be conceptually interesting. It's a funny element of reality because the element of reality is now is what I would call a non-property of these individuals. It simply says when I measure particle one, I can predict how the measurement results on the other two will relate to each other should they be measured. So it says, for example, it says in this case, if I measure H here, the other two are either both horizontal or both vertical in the same basis, or also in the rotated by 45 degrees or whatever you want. So we predict with certainty an element of reality which is not an element of reality in the sense of a feature we can assign to individual objects. Okay, so this to me undermines a little bit more the picture that in quantum mechanics we're talking about the reality out there. Okay, so this is this experiment is as basic as all the other experiments. This is the kind of picture which, for example, David Mermin made famous in his papers in Physics Today long ago. You have a source which, in his case, emits two particles. You have two settings of the apparatus, and you have two possible outcomes. The only difference now being that this is a two-particle state here, and the setting of apparatus here doesn't switch around polarization, but it switches around different entangled states. So you have perfect correlations in the same way as we had them before. You have perfect correlations for one kind of state, plus plus, minus minus. For other parameters, you have perfect correlations plus minus minus plus. The question now to ask is, can we observe CHA's HVL violation? If you do this, we need to look at superpositions on both sides. On that side is the superposition of different polarizations. Here we need a superposition of these two entangled states. Sorry, this, okay. This should be psi minus, it doesn't matter. The way to do the experiment is we use our standard machinery, namely pump a nonlinear crystal twice with a short pulse. So we look at the situation where we get one pair here and one pair here. And we superpose these two photons as a polarized beam splitter. We only look at the situation where this photon here has a certain polarization at 0 degrees. And this is Alice's apparatus. She has a polarizer whose orientations she can change. And over there is Bob's apparatus. He determines which is the Bell state of these two photons. By reflecting the two photons at the polarized beam splitter, this is an idea of Pittman and Franzen. You can identify Bell states using the property that the polarized beam splitter either reflect when two photons come in, they are both reflected, they are in the same polarization state without determining the polarization. And you can switch around between the various entangled states by reorienting a half-wave plate in front of the polarizer. That's the experimental result. Just the kind of sinusoidal fringes, as you know them from all these experiments. You have seen them many times. These are the sinusoidal fringes. These are fourfold coincidences as a function of Alice's polarizer angle, where the full circle is where you look at the other side at one of the entangled state. It should be phi minus, I apologize. And the dashed line is simply a rotation in the Hilbert space of the two particles such that you have a superposition of the two systems. So this is, as I said, this is nothing really new in the sense that it's not expected, but I think it puts a little bit more into doubt a realistic picture of trying to understand experiment. Now, in a realistic way. Now I have still half an hour or something like that. Okay. Now to some other experiments, which you might find interesting. It was already mentioned by Danny in his talk. This thing which we called entanglement swapping. If we should have better called it teleportation of entanglement, that would have had which would have sounded more attractive. But never mind, that's the way it is. A conceptually interesting point about this entanglement swapping. As Danny mentioned, we have a source which creates two entangled pairs, and we superpose one photon each from each pair in such a way that we project these two onto the entangled states and the outer two ones become entangled. Now, these can be photons which don't share any common path. They can be completely independent of each other, which is quite clear. You can get the violation of Bell's inequality, which also is quite clear. And I want to mention now one point which is of interest. You heard today in the beautiful talk of Alain Aspé this kind of this kind of bunching behavior. If you have two photons, and you superimpose them here, this at the beam splitter, two photons, you superimpose them, or two bosons at the beam splitter, then you get the destructive interference of two possibilities, namely that both photons go through or both photons are reflected, which shows as if you look at coincidences out here as a function of flight time difference, it shows up as a dip where this essentially goes down to zero. That's the well-known Hong-U Mendel dip. That's the way you do the experiment. Now, a point I want to stress is that this phenomenon is not limited to bosons. Not all bosons behave. It's not limited to bosons, and not all bosons behave that way. For example, a standard procedure in many of these experiments is to create antisymmetric states. You can do this with photons. You can have a state HV minus VH, where this is polarization. And when you have these two photons incident on the beam splitter, they behave like fermions. They behave like fermions. They obey something like the Pauli principle. You get, if you now look at coincidences as a function of flight time difference, you get a peak, and in the end, you get only, if the flight time difference is zero, you only get photons, one in each beam. The reverse holds for electrons, by the way. You can, for electrons, you can expect the same kind of behavior in principle. So for electrons, you expect this kind of behavior, but it should also be possible, which has not been done yet, it should also be possible to create a symmetric state for electrons, symmetric in spin, for example, and get the Hongo-Mendel. Now, the conceptually interesting point I would like to mention about teleportation is an idea proposed by Asher Peres in 2001. And he simply said, you can conceive of the following situation. You have your two entangled photon sources, and you do your projection on an entangled state called the Bell state measurement, Bell state analysis, but you now do it at the time after these two photons have been registered. Then what happens is that this measurement projects after the measurement, it projects these two onto an entangled state, which have already been registered. But alternatively, Alice could decide not to do a Bell state analysis here, but measure the two photons individually. If she measures the two photons individually, she would confirm that this guy is entangled with this one, this is entangled with this one, and one and four are not at all entangled with each other. How can that be? How can that be if the results for one and four have been registered already? How can that be if they have been registered already? Now, the answer is simple. The answer is simple. We call him Victor, maybe. Victor writes down the results for these two photons, one and four, but he doesn't know what they mean. There's no correlation whatsoever between the two different data. And now, when he gets the news from Alice, which entangled state she measured, he can sort these data into four subsets, and each subset makes complete sense and tells you that these two were entangled. But on the other hand, if Alice decided not to do a Bell state analysis, but measure the particles individually, the photons individually, he can again separate the data into four subsets. Now, each of the subsets, now being completely different subsets, each of the subsets now telling you that this guy was entangled with this one, this entangled with this one. Now, what that tells, it's no surprise, it's everything is expected, and the experiment confirms that. But what this tells us is that the event, the individual event, the event which is registered here, is something very fundamental. It's more fundamental than the way we talk about it. We cannot talk about the event, we cannot make sense of it, we cannot make a picture of it before we know the whole story of the whole thing. But the event is already there, and the event doesn't care whether it belongs. You know, the registered event for photon one does not care whether the picture we make up tells us that this is entangled with that guy or whether it's entangled with that guy. So the way we talk about it is something which comes after the individual event. Now, one point, a further step into the future, which you might find interesting. I have to look at time. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. This kind of teleportation of entanglement is considered by some as an ingredient of future quantum repeaters, if you want to have long distance quantum communication. That's actually one of the biggest surprises for me, that this kind of stuff we are doing might be useful in the future information technology. I never expected that. I don't know if Alain, if you expected that. But, and I'm convinced that it will be part of the future right. So that's really funny. But anyway, now that way you can hope to bridge to bridge the communication between two quantum computers which might be separated over a large distance. Now, there have been series of experiments like our experiment where we pumped the same one crystal with the same laser to create one crystal with the same laser to create the two pairs. Nicolas Chissin here and his group did a nice experiment where they had two separated crystals, but again pumped by the same laser. And we really wanted to show that you can do it with completely separated lasers. In order to do this, you need to have basically nothing is necessary. You simply have to create photons here and photon pairs here, and you simply look at those photons which arrive here at the time within the time which is short compared to the coherence time. Now the problem is that such detectors don't exist. Detectors which are so fast that don't exist, and also the phase space density of the photons would be too small. So in the experiment, you pump these two crystals with femtosecond lasers, such that the pairs are created simultaneously, sufficiently simultaneously, but then you have to stabilize these two lasers well with each other. And that is a technology which was not available until recently. So in our experiment, we have two of these lasers which are only electronically stabilized. We wanted to do an experiment where the two photons share no common optical path whatsoever. I should mention there's a nice experiment by Jianwei Pan where these lasers are not electronically stabilized, but they share a cavity together, which is a beautiful experiment, but it's not really completely separated. Now, in that experiment, here's the result. In that experiment, you see, we call it fully independent sources. You see this Hongu-Mendel dip. If the two photons, you can now choose the polarization here, if the two photons have the same polarization. Okay? If the two photons have orthogonal polarization, you get no dip because the photons are distinguishable, and you can play some other games which are interesting. If you leave the two photons unpolarized, then the dip is significantly reduced because sometimes they carry different polarization can be distinguished. And this is what we call the thermal light case, which is looking only at the coincidences between the two photons by only measuring the outer two photons, but not at the coincidences there. But that's not so important. Now, I come to the final physics part, and then I want to talk a little bit about the interpretive question, because I have been challenged yesterday in the discussion already that way. In 2003, a very interesting paper by Tony Leggett appeared in Foundations of Physics, of which he told me today that the work is about 30 years old or something like that, but he didn't publish it for a long time. The paper is about what he calls crypto non-local hidden variable theories. So we all know that Bell's work excluded local hidden variable theories. Now the question is, can you say anything about non-local hidden variable theories? Because after all, quantum mechanics, you might interpret, some people might interpret this as a non-local hidden variable theory if you want, okay? It was my attitude until we heard about Tony's paper that it doesn't make much sense to scratch your head about non-local hidden variable theories in terms of making sure that they or testing them in this kind of spin experiment. I know there are there are quite a number of non-local theories around, but they all have to narrow down the parameter of possible spaces. Now, what Leggett does is he invents what he calls crypto non-local hidden variable theories, which have the following interesting features. Firstly, they confirm all predictions for, they agree with all predictions for individual photons. That's important. So, for example, Malus's law and things like that. The second important point is that they agree with all experiments on pairs so far. So they have to give the perfect correlations if you for example, in a spin experiment, spin 1/2 experiment, that the two spins are anti-parallel for any possible direction. And finally, they should also give all the correlations between two particles as they have been observed in experiments so far, which, and that is interesting now, have been confined to one plane on the Poincaré sphere. So this is the picture done by Markus Aspelmeier, which I borrowed for this talk. We have an entangled source. We have our two measurement apparatuses, and we can switch around here between different parameters. Actually, not just in one dimension. This should be a little bit more complicated. We can have two outputs, A and B, and we look at the correlations. The idea is that the measurement outcomes are determined by pre-existing properties of particles independent of the measurement. So the particles carry the properties. And the physical state are the statistical mixtures of sub-ensemble with definite polarization. And furthermore, this connects to the point that single particle prediction should be obeyed. Polarization is defined such that the expectation values taken for each sub-ensemble obey Malus's law. And the assumption is that we have a kind of a non-local dependence in principle, that the result on side A depends on the apparatus setting on side A, apparatus setting on side B, and on the result B, and likewise for B. Now, in our work, we restrict ourselves to just assuming this kind of dependence on the apparatus setting, not on the results. Okay, this is just to connect to the usual equations in the derivation of a bell type inequality. For example, the parameter A is a function of a local hidden variable lambda on one side. On the polarization the particle carries, there's an assumption that the particle carries some polarization, this is the orientation of your polarizer, and these are all other parameters you might want to include, including parameters on the other side, apparatus settings, results, and so on in principle. And the requirement is of Malus's law is that if you integrate an ensemble over all hidden variables on that side, then you must obtain Malus's, this is basically Malus's law here. And the correlations between both sides are obtained in a similar way. Now, to talk about the experimental parameters here, we create our type 2 entangled photons, polarization entangled photons. We look for the correlations on both sides. And I want to connect this to the history, a little bit to the history of these experiments. I know this doesn't take justice to all the experiments which have been done over the time. There was a prehistory of this kind of experiments, which goes back to Wu and Chaknov, who basically measured if this is a Poincaré type sphere, horizontal vertical polarization, or you can view it as spin 1/2 up and down. They restricted, unfortunately, their experiment just to these orthogonal states. They didn't, if I am I'm not mistaken, they didn't think, okay, I'm sorry, 5 minutes, oh my God, time flies. to these orthogonal states. So they weren't able to detect when Bell came out. I understand that the attitude of some people was that this has already been tested in experiment, but it wasn't. Now, then the lesson of Bell is that you have to look at other directions in the plane, at other correlations in other directions. You can actually explain the perfect correlation. You look at other directions and you get violations. I have written down the names of some experimentalists here. And now the new idea is that if you go out of the plane, if you go out of this plane here, then you can test. So this is a generalization, stepwise generalization. If you go out of the plane, you can test for the kind of non-local proposals, a concept which Leggett made. And here's an experimental result. A kind of a generalized correlation function as a as a function of this angle of being outside this plane. And here's the bound given by the by this non-local hidden variable theory, and that's the experiment. So that's, that kind of non-local hidden variable theory is also excluded by experiment. By the way, we also did a GHSH test of the same state just to make sure that the it also violates usual locality. Now I want to cancel that one-way quantum computation. I want to cancel all that. And I just want to provoke you guys now with my philosophical thing. It's before the dinner, so I can talk a little bit nonsense if I am allowed. This is the naive. Abner is laughing already. The simple question. You know, Abner has yesterday has said that we have to close this circle of knowledge and information of reality and information. And the claim I want to make is a very drastic one. The first point I suggest is that all information is classical, despite the fact that I am a co-editor of a book which has the title The Physics of Quantum Information. I don't believe that such a thing as quantum information exists. All information is classical. This also has already been said by Bohr. However far the quantum phenomena transcend the scope of classical physical explanation, the account of all evidence must be expressed in classical terms. Now this he really said. The other quote, but So the quantum information is only the representation of classical information in a classical formalism. Now the second point we have been asking ourselves is how does the information content of a system scale with the size of the system? And there's a nice Feynman quote. It always bothers me that it takes a computing machine an infinite number of logical operations to figure out what goes on in no matter how tiny a region of space. Why should it take an infinite amount of logic to figure out what one tiny piece of space-time is going to do? I really like that. That's very clever. So we ask ourselves, we said that the information you assign to a system must scale with the size of a system. So large systems, usually called classical systems, are characterized by a huge number of bits. And it is the characteristic of a classical system is that we never know all the information which is necessary to characterize the system. So a classical system is a system where we lack information, actually. Quantum system is a system where we have all the information to completely characterize the state. Now, if we go to smaller and smaller systems, then we arrive at the natural limit, namely that the most elementary system is to be characterized by one bit of information. And that helps you in understanding some things. For example, quantum interference. Mike said in his talk, we don't know why there is quantum interference. I think I know. I mean, the basic point is that we only have one bit of information available, and this bit of information can be used to either specify which path the particle takes or which of these two detectors fires. If you use it for one of the two, then the other one must be by necessity incomplete. So actually, there are three complementary variables here, not just two, but that's a different story. So if you use your bit of information to determine the path, then it must be undetermined which of these two detectors fires. And likewise, if you use the bit of information by determining, for example, by defining that this detector has to fire, then the path must by necessity be completely undefined. Just to mention one more result of this kind of thinking is you find that you get a natural explanation of entanglement. If you have two elementary systems in that sense, you have two bits of information available. Classical coding would assign one bit here, one bit here. Quantum mechanics tells us that you can use both bits of information to define common features of the two systems should they be observed. Now, these are just two bits of information, means four possibilities. These are just the four Bell states. Now, to provoke you guys a little bit more and have some discussion for dinner, I just want to expose here some of my viewpoints. Now, what is the quantum state? To me, the quantum state is really just a representation of information and no more, period. Okay? Information about what? Clearly about results of observation. That simply means about features of a classical apparatus and no more, the apparatus which I use. And what it is for? It's for calculating probabilities of future events. That means future possible features of classical apparatus, and again, no more. We don't need to have to talk about the quantum system and its state and so on. Second slide to make Avner smile. What about the measurement problem? You know, I'm one of those who denies the measurement problem. There is no measurement problem. And I really don't understand why there is a measurement, why people talk about the measurement problem. Now, how come? This has been said by Heisenberg already. Isn't it most natural that if your quantum state is a representation of your information, that you have to change that representation of information if what you know changes? It cannot be more natural than that. And so Heisenberg said it already very nicely. The act of recording is not a physical, but rather, so to say, a mathematical process, just on my piece of paper, you know. With a sudden change of our knowledge, also the mathematical representation of our knowledge undergoes, of course, a sudden change. This has been said by Heisenberg already in 1960. Now the complete challenge to show how silly I am in using notions. To me, the message of quantum physics is that we really have to unify our notions of information and reality. We should give up this kind of distinction. They should, in a sense, I tell you why. We have learned in physics that it is important not to make distinctions which we cannot operationally verify. We should not make distinctions which we cannot operationally verify. Now, there is no way to operationally verify in an experiment or whatsoever the difference between reality and information. So we must modify our concepts such that the two, in a sense, are two sides of the same coin. This is not to say that everything is just information. Now, if you want to read a little bit about that, Hans Christian von Bayer wrote a nice paper about this kind of thinking in 2001 in New Scientist. So the last thing was. You might not agree with everything, but I have a famous quote here, which you might like. This is a quote about Einstein's membership. You know, when Einstein was proposed, came to Berlin, he was actually made a member of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, which at that time ran the institutes. They had laboratories and so on. And the letter was signed, among others, by Max Planck. And it says, "The undersigned members of the Academy have the honor to propose the Professor Dr. Albert Einstein, Professor of the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule in Zurich, for a membership in the Academy." And they also proposed a salary, actually. That's quite interesting. These were four scientists. Nernst was one of them. Laue was one of them. I forgot the fourth name. This is interesting, dass er in seinen Spekulationen gelegentlich auch einmal über das Ziel hinausgeschossen haben mag, wie zum Beispiel in seiner Hypothese der Lichtquanten, wird man ihm nicht allzu so schwer anrechnen dürfen. So, you should not hold it against him that he might have gone too far at some points, for example, when he proposed these ideas of quanta of light. This was 1913. This was 1913. Because without accepting some risk or daring some risks at some time, you can also in the most exactest of the natural scientists, you cannot introduce anything really new. So I hope you view what I said you as a risk in that direction. Now, to go back to reality, one of the things we hope we will be doing someday, and this closes the loop of possible applications of the stuff which Abner has been interested in all his life, is to put some of these photon sources on satellites and establish quantum communication between two different locations on the Earth. Nicolas Chissin, who is here, his group is part of our team, and we hope to be able to put the money together for this kind of thing, or to have a satellite where you can send this little funny, you can send two entangled photons down to two different telescopes and two locations on Earth and have a long distance Bell inequality of a couple thousand kilometers and so on. And if they ever go to Mars, they should utilize this for a quantum non-locality experiment. And they must be bored when they fly there, you know. So they could write, well, I guess. Well. So this is a picture of my group. It's slightly outdated. Taken very close to our laboratory. And I want to close with this picture here, which I found on the internet. I've been showing about it, dead and alive. So, you know, maybe someday we will see this kind of poster somewhere. Thank you very much. Oh yes, if I take my approach serious, which I do, then the wave function of the universe does not make sense. Exactly. We either need a new theory, or we need some experiments which show us that it actually doesn't make sense to talk about the wave function of the universe. Well, it might actually make sense to talk today as a classical observer about the wave function of the universe way back. I don't see a contradiction there. Okay, but the wave function of the universe now, I cannot see that it can make much sense. Right. Thank you. Well, that's a very interesting suggestion. Thank you. I mean, I think I can put these things in agreement with my view of information, but I don't want to do that now. Your suggestion is very good. We should. It's a very interesting. Thank you. Oh, it's very good. Thank you. Thank you. Bye. Well, I don't believe that. I think God would also have to talk about the world in a classical language. Not your God. Well, there are actually three complementary variables in the situation, and one is the path taken, and the other one is the variable which tells you which detectors fire, and the third one is which detectors fire if you have an additional phase of 90 degrees. And with the three variables, they correspond to the three components of spin 1/2. You can describe the whole situation. And then what the phase place does is simply it rotates that space. So in order to explain that, we have to assume something about the homogeneity of the influence of that parameter. And if we do that, we can explain the sinusoidal fringes. It's like polarization, yeah. No, I was simply saying that interference lives in a two-dimensional space like polarization. And in polarization, you have three complementary variables. Here, you also have three, which people are usually not aware. Yeah, it translates. And the phase plate corresponds to a rotation of your spin thing. Now, in order to get the sinus, we need to assume something about the homogeneity of the influence of that parameter. That is an additional assumption.